The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, a two-hour special. The first hour you can hear on WMYE, WPFW, KPFK, and all the other stations that hear us in live time. But then the second hour you can listen by going to Progressive Radio Network or GaryKnoll.com. A one-and-a-half-hour special today on the truth behind vaccines. We will be exploring the age of autism. That it is indeed, we will prove absolutely with hard evidence that it is a man-made epidemic. It is the mercury in the vaccines, and that our government and its agencies and agents have well known this for over 50 years, but have hidden this from us. Why? What is their motives? And what about all the scientists and the media and the organizations that continue to support that it's due to some genetic defect in the parents? We'll explore this in depth with Mark Blaxell and Dan Oldstein. Then we will look at the science behind vaccines. Are they safe and are they effective? We must assume that they are, or we wouldn't have been given them. It wouldn't be mandated as a part of public policy. But indeed, we will show you and prove unequivocally there is no science to support safety and efficacy of vaccines, individually or collectively, that this is a massive public fraud. Dr. Lawrence Povesky, board-certified pediatrician, will be here to share that with us. And finally, in the last half hour, between 1:30 and 2, we will have Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who is a board-certified physician, both in integrative medicine and in allergies and women's issues, and she will talk about the flu politics and vaccination and what's actually in the vaccine ingredients. We will tell you exclusively, for the first time that you will hear it, new ingredients in the flu vaccine you would not want in your body, sodium deoxychloroethane, and what it will do to you. So we have a news-making program lined up. I also want to share with you that there has been a lot of cynicism and almost apathy in many of the individuals who at once were conservatives or once liberals, Democrats and Republicans, who now have seen the corruption, the self-serving interest within their own parties, and how neither party has resolved to stand on principle and to make it a better country for everyone, not just for their own particular political groups. And as a result, more than ever before, people are leaving these parties and simply becoming independent. In fact, the majority of teabaggers call themselves independents, not Republicans. And yet it was about equally divided between them, having at one time been both Democrats and Republicans. I want you to know that you should be optimistic. Why? Not in the short term. In the short term, things will get worse, and we will have some of the most egregious examples of individuals elected through their different parties to run our country. But while that is happening, and while it is getting worse, there will also be a coming together of minds who will put aside egos and political differences and say, let us work together towards the future for America. And in that context, the Progressive Radio Network has brought these minds together. So you can hear them each day. Jim Hightower, Danny Schechter, Matthew Rothschild, Mike Adams, John Rappaport, Norman Solomon, Robert Scheer, Michael Rupert, Jake Towne, Mark Summer, Michael and Justin Toms, Dr. Mara Eisenstein, Dr. Ronald Klatz, Stephen Ledman, Dr. Helena Caldicott, Dr. Michio Kaku, just to name a few. So we are collecting in one place independent progressive minds who will be helping to formulate the arguments for how we can make it a better world in the future. So do not despair. It is not all lost. With that, I would like to share with you two particular commentaries, my own thoughts, as well as those from Professor James Quinn, a leading economist with the University of Pennsylvania, from theburningplatform.com on Those Who Don't Build Must Burn, and Norman Solomon from our own Progressive Radio Network on No Higher Consciousness Won't Save You This Time from commondreams.org. And I came to this idea when I realized in a series of discussions unrelated to this topic today, when I was filming around the United States for two films, one on how to be a healthy vegetarian, and within that film, I have whole sections on genetic engineering, the movement back to the land, organic, and then one on Poverty USA. Now, of course, poverty is not exclusive to the USA, but what we're seeing now is there's more poverty than ever before, including even during the Great Depression in the United States, with a new class of people who are poor. We're now seeing the professional poor. We're seeing people who were lawyers and engineers and architects who are now out of work, losing their homes. And we have a whole group of people who are college graduates who also are being challenged economically. And if they didn't have a good social network and families to rely upon, these people would even cause the number of the poor to grow probably to double what it is now. I'm guesstimating the official number of about 55 million is half of what it is. We're really looking at about 100 million Americans. One third, one in every three Americans, not one in seven, are actually now considered poor. And when talking with a lot of young people outside of Columbia University, New York University, down on Wall Street, I was surprised to see how little of true literacy existed, including with graduate students, people who studied only what was required and only to the degree necessary to get their grades and get out, but not because that study, that reading, empowered them and broadened their perspective and insights. Ray Bradbury wrote his dystonian novel, Fahrenheit 451. Now, for anyone over the age of 45, there's a high probability you either read the book or remember the film. He wrote that in 1950, but the film didn't come out until the 70s. Most kids were required to read this book when they were 17 years old. And having just reread the novel, it makes you realize how little you knew at 17. It's a small novel. It's only 165 pages, but does it have great insights? And I'm going to ask for everyone in this audience to take just a few hours and reread Fahrenheit 451. The American public was willingly chosen to be distracted and entertained by electronic gadgets 24 hours a day. And that's what Bradbury feared. He feared that America, in the future, would become a hedonistic, dark place. And his worst fears have been realized. We're wired 24 hours a day. Today, reading books is for old people. Most people think Bradbury's novel was a warning about censorship. It was not. It was a warning about TV and radio turning the minds of Americans to mush. It's now 60 years later, and his warning went unheeded. A self-imposed ignorance by a vast swath of the American public is reflected in these statistics. 33% of high school graduates never read another book for the rest of their lives. 42% of college graduates never read another book after college. 80% of American families do not buy or read even one book a year. 70% of Americans have not been in a bookstore in the last 5 years. 57% of new books are not read to completion. There are over 17,000 radio stations and 2,000 televisions in America today. Each day in the U.S., people spend an average of 4.7 hours watching TV, 3 hours listening to radio, and 14 minutes reading magazines. The projected average number of hours an individual, 12 or older, will spend watching television this year, 1,750 hours. In a 65-year life, the average person will spend 9 years watching television. The number of 30-second TV commercials you'll see in a year, 20,000. The number of videos rented daily in the United States, 6 million. The number of public library items checked out daily, 3 million. Percentage of Americans who can name the Three Stooges, 59%. Percentage who can name at least three justices of the United States Supreme Court, 17%. So when Ray Bradbury wrote his novel in the basement of the UCLA library on a pay-per-hour typewriter, television was in its infancy. In 1945, there were only 10,000 television sets in all of America. By 1950, there were only 6 million sets. The U.S. population was 150 million, living in 20 or 43 million households. Only 9% of these households had a television. There was one TV for every 25 people. I remember when we didn't have a television, and I remember when we did, we were only allowed to watch it Saturday morning for 2 hours and Sunday evening as a family together. Americans read books and newspapers to be aware of their world. Today, there are 335 million television sets in America. The U.S. population is 310 million, living in 115 million households. There is a television in 99% of the households, with an average of three televisions per household. Your reality is whatever the corporate media decides your reality is. Bradbury envisioned gigantic flat-screen wall TVs that interacted with the audience and people wearing seashell earlobes so they could listen to the radio. Anything to keep you from reading, thinking, questioning, or wondering. Today, anesthetized kids, non-thinking adults, sit in front of the boob tube with their PlayStation controllers in hand and a microphone attached to their ear, killing zombies while talking to their fellow warriors, sitting in their own living room somewhere in the world. Apple sold 260 million iPods since 2001 that allow people to zone out and live in their own private music world, never ending and never needing to interact or associate with their fellow humans. Millions of BlackBerry addicts roam the streets of our cities like androids, forcing alert pedestrians to bob and weave to avoid head-on collision with these connected egomaniacs. They're overwhelmed with their own self-importance. I'm writing a book on this now as I speak. I'll have it finished in the next 3 months, called Less Than Zero: The New Generation. For those who cannot read the book and for some reason or choose not to, let me give you a real quick summary. Guy Montag is a fireman who burns books in a futuristic American city. In this dystopian world, firemen start fires rather than putting them out. The people in this society do not read books. They do not enjoy nature. They do not spend time by themselves. They do not think independently or have meaningful conversations, ever. Instead, they drive at extreme speeds, watch excessive amounts of television on wall sides, screens, and listen to the radio on seashell radio, sets attached to their ears. Guy meets a girl that makes him rethink his priorities. He starts to question book burning and why people fear books. After not showing up for work, his boss, Beatty, comes to his house and explains why books are now banned. According to Beatty, special interest groups and other minorities objected to the books that offended them. Soon, books all began to look the same. All writers tried to avoid offending anybody. This was not enough, however, and society as a whole decided to simply burn all the books in the world rather than permit any conflicting opinions. Montag connects with a retired English professor named Faber, who tells him that the value of books lies in the detailed awareness of life that they contain. Faber says that Montag needs not only books, but also the leisure to read them and the freedom to act on their ideas. After Montag's wife turns him in and he's forced to burn his own house to the ground, he turns his flamethrower on Beatty. He is hunted by a mechanical hound and the chase is broadcast on national television. He escapes to the forest where he finds a group of renegade intellectuals, the Book People, led by a man named Granger, who welcome him. They are part of a nationwide network of book lovers who have memorized many great works of literature and philosophy. They hope that they may be of some help to mankind in the aftermath of the war that has just been declared. Montag's role is to memorize the book of Ecclesiastes. Enemy jets appear in the sky and completely obliterate the city with atomic bombs, and Montag and his new friends move on to search for survivors and rebuild civilization. That's a summary. Now, we have to understand that today in our society, on the one hand, we have the media, left and right. They are engaged in willful ignorance and are completely averse to knowledge on both sides. In Bradbury's novel, the fireman's duty is to destroy knowledge and promote ignorance in order to equalize the population and promote sameness. Any impartial analysis of the current state of affairs must conclude that he was absolutely right. And by the way, Ray Bradbury, I don't know if he's alive today, but in 2007 he was, and he did an interview with the LA Weekly, and he says, "Television gives you the dates of Napoleon, but not who he was." Bradbury says, summarizing TV's content with a single word that he spits out as an epithet, factoids. His fear in 1953 that television would kill books he says, been partially confirmed by television's effect on substance in the news. Useless, he says. They stuff you with so much useless information you feel full. Bradbury wrote his novel shortly after World War II at the outset of the Korean War and during the early stages of the Cold War and in the midst of McCarthyism. The novel reflects these influences. Orwell's 1984 used television screens to indoctrinate citizens. Bradbury envisioned television as an opiate, keeping the public sedated. The wall televisions in Fahrenheit 451 allow characters to interact with those watching. Bradbury captured the future of reality TV. Now think for a moment, friends. Entertainment today is dominated by reality TV. We are blasted with the likes of Jersey Shore, American Idol, America's Got Talent, Survivor, Big Brother, Project Runway, Dancing with the Stars, Amazing Race, Housewives of D.C., New Jersey, New York, Atlanta. I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant, and 50 other mind-numbing reality shows. Morons with names like Snooki and The Situation are better known by teenagers than George Washington Thomas Jefferson. In Bradbury's world, television was used to broadcast meaningless, trivial, to divert attention and thought away from an impending war. Today, television is used to broadcast meaningless drivel to divert attention and thought away from ongoing wars, government corruption, impending financial collapse, and, worst of all, the truth in all things. Bradbury directly foretells something. He says that Montag spends the entire novel seeking truth. Professor Faber becomes his mentor, leading him towards the truth. It is not a coincidence that Bradbury's named the Montag character after a paper company and that the Faber character after a pencil company. Faber was the instrument through which Montag was taught. Montag was clearly fighting an uphill battle. The majority had stopped thinking and seeking truth decades ago. The majority always wants things to remain the same. Government did not need to ban books. As technology advanced and filled the day with 24 hours of entertainment, infomercials, propaganda, and trivia, the population willfully stopped reading books. Why think, why ponder, or question when you can be entertained and directed to believe in whatever the state thinks is best? When entertainment wasn't enough, the population would drive their cars at speeds exceeding 100 miles an hour with the goal of running animals and people over. Today, the mainstream media is controlled by a few mega corporations that do not care what you think. They are responsible for keeping the population sedated, entertained, confused, and misinformed. The public willfully accepts a reality presented by those in power, rather than thinking, questioning, or seeking the truth. In America's pleasure society, we drive as fast as we want, heedless of danger. We care only for our own gratification, not for the welfare of others. For enjoyment, we memorize lyrics of Eminem rap songs. Thinking is not pleasurable, so we envelop ourselves in flat-screen, high-def TVs that provide nonstop distraction. Reading books is no longer necessary in our world. This is reflected in the fact that 40% of all adults in America can be classified as functionally illiterate, and probably 95% of the people in their 20s, from my own personal observations and conversations. Well, correct that. One-sided conversations. The U.S. public school system has been so dumbed down by teachers, the teachers' unions, the school boards, the parents, the principals, and the students, all of them working together to see how they can race to the bottom. And it is the exceptional teacher, the exceptional parent, the exceptional student who decides to challenge the system. And they do this with equality of all as the mantra that one wonders whether the state's purposely wants to process non-thinking, non-questioning Autobots into society. After all, thinking, questioning public is an extremely dangerous group. Bradbury imagined a democratic society whose diverse population turns against books. He imagined not just political correctness, but a society so diverse that all groups were minorities. It was essential that all thought became like vanilla tapioca. First, they condensed the book, stripping out more and more offending passages until ultimately all that remained were footnotes. Only after people stopped reading on their own did the state employ firemen to burn books. Once the sacrifice of liberty to the state was made, the state will not restore it without a fight. Political correctness has not been taken to the extreme by those in power in America. The textbooks used to educate our children have all been offensive facts extracted. History has been revised to satisfy the agendas of those in power. The truth is of no consequence when a minority group might be offended. History books used in our public schools have been referenced by Marilyn Monroe. More references to her than George Washington. Bradbury was prescient in his ability to see the future denigrate and hence not having the capacity to even gain wisdom. Our public schools have the power to place students into roles such as a runner, a football player, a swimmer, a soccer star. But being placed in a role, a person is doing what is expected of him or her and not being an individual. We dread the unfamiliar. To be an individual is to be unfamiliar. Thus, to conform is easier. The ruling elite and the mainstream media are openly scornful and antagonistic towards those they label intellectuals. Fox News and MSNBC prefer talking points, misinformation, bloated megalomaniacs, and dogmatic ideology, or those who spout the leftist ideology as if they're on Quaaludes, and have no resemblance to true democracy, talk about democracy and moniker it. In point of fact, all they are is dogmatic ideology from their anchor, entertainers, and insipid guests. The numbskulls on these shows are never in doubt of, and always wrong. There's no true debate between reasonable people. These entertainment shows appeal to the baser emotional instincts of the public, not to the reason or intellect. The American public no longer has the capacity to criticize anything in a truly analytical way. What they are told by mainstream corporate media stays as their truth. They gave up reading books decades ago, leading to a steady decline in critical thinking skills. No need to think when you can go bungee jumping, mountain biking, skydiving, yachting, ball painting, or binge drinking. In the ultimate irony, Bradbury found out in 2003 that over the years, editors at Ballantine had censored 75 separate sections of his novel, fearful that it would contaminate the minds of our young. The idea of today's censorship is not to burn books, except for, well, let's see, who wanted to burn books? Who wanted to collect books? Who's that guy on television at night and on radio in the morning? Glenn Beck. Yes. Who said he, quote, despised progressives? Yes, 2 days ago. Glenn Beck. No. The American public no longer has the capacity to critically analyze what they're told by the mainstream corporate media And as a result, today, books are not so generic and bland, or are so generic and bland, that no one would want to read them anyway. Bradbury is still full of anger 6 years after writing his masterpiece. And in conclusion, Bradbury had known nothing but war from the time he was 18 until he wrote Fahrenheit 451 at the age of 30. He described the sound of bombers continuously flying over the city. America started two nuclear wars since 1990. The degenerative effects of mass media in today's infobite world can be clearly seen in how they are able to manipulate public opinion to support undeclared wars without questioning. Maybe I missed it. Maybe somewhere along the way, we've had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission by the Democrats, by the unions, by the school teachers, to get those who said there were weapons of mass destruction and have caused 1.5 million innocent Iraqi deaths, thousands of Americans to die, tens of thousands to be permanently injured, trillions of dollars to be spent needlessly, all the while no one ever held accountable. Surely that couldn't exist today, but it does. If America were still able to think and interested in exercising their responsibilities as citizens of a republic, they would have required that Congress exercise its responsibility to declare war rather than allow one man to declare and wage wars all over the globe, and another man to continue with his legacy. It is easy when the state controls the message. Montag is stalked by the mechanical hound throughout the book. It was programmed to hunt down Montag and to lethally inject him with poison. Bradbury didn't know, but he had described an early version of a predator drone. Today a man can sit in front of his computer in the Pentagon and direct an unnamed predator drone to fire missiles at so-called enemies without faces halfway around the world. No danger, no consequences, no responsibility. The American public blindly believes the state is protecting them from murdering enemies of the state. They take away your rights and you say nothing. They take away your constitutional liberties and you say nothing. They take away your right to organic produce, you say nothing. They take away your right to talk on a phone or on a computer, you say nothing. They arrest those that are considered enemies of the state, those who stand up and protest for freedom, and you say nothing. The hunt for Montaigne was broadcast on national TV. Bradbury's imagination produced a vision of fake reality TV 50 years before it became an everyday reality. As I read this passage, visions of O.J. Simpson's slow speed chase along the L.A. freeways appeared in my mind. It was immediately followed by the fake balloon boy video from about a year ago. Lastly, the streaming video of oil gushing into the Gulf of Mexico came into focus. When the cameras were turned off, the show is over. Cold-blooded murders are released due to political correctness. A child in danger was just a show. The effects of the 200 million gallons of oil spilled in the Gulf of Mexico on the environment and its citizens of the region aren't apparent when the cameras are turned off, so therefore there are no effects. The world today is one big TV reality show. The populace wants to be entertained by its news. Sound bites are essential. Dazzling special effects are required. Beautiful people presented the show is necessary. Facts are optional. The truth is a nuance, and there is only one requirement. The show must go on. There are few builders left, while millions of burners lurk behind every bush. First it will be the Qurans and the mosques, then it will be the Bibles and the churches, then it will be the libraries, the liberals, the progressives. Eventually it will be your house. America was built by those who cherish liberty, freedom, responsibility, knowledge, and truth. A fog of complacency and malaise settled over America in the last 60 years. It is almost as if Orwell's 1984, Huxley's Brave New World, and Fahrenheit 451 were used as instruction manuals rather than warnings by our society. The worst aspects from all three of these dystopian novels have been adopted or implemented in present-day America. The citizenry has become dependent upon the state of information, direction, support, and protection. The unquestioning obedience towards the faceless, nameless, feckless, hapless state bureaucracy will lead to tyranny. The state will demand your compliance. The state will monitor your thoughts and movements. The state will tell you what to believe. The state will brutally punish anyone who attempts to think or question. The books are piled high. We begin with complacency. From there, we go to dependency. Dependency then becomes tyranny. And only from tyranny will there be revolution, and from revolution comes liberty. I'm Gary Knoll, James Quinn, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
You better stop, yeah! Longer, my heart's getting weak. It's not getting any stronger. You keep me so upset. My head's in a whirl. But if you wanna be my girl, you'd better stop.
Gary Knoll, this is the one place left on the planet where people who want to have intelligent conversations, in-depth dialogue, without any shortcuts, but with the footnotes in place, can do so. The Progressive Radio Network. We are going to shift gears for the next hour and a half. We are going to look with the truth towards autism. Now, the reason I just shared with you an in-depth analysis of Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's important book, was because of how complacent people became, how many people were easily manipulated by a state truth, an official truth. And I believe that we have been victims of this right as we speak. We've been told that autism is based upon defective genes, that your child happens to be the canary in the coal mine, and that it's unfortunate your child was born susceptible, but it's all about the susceptibility and the genes you gave them, not about anything that he was exposed or she was exposed to in the vaccines. I have two individuals now who are going to offer their challenges. My guest, Mark Blaxall, is the father of a daughter diagnosed with autism, editor at large of Age of Autism, a director of Safe Minds, and a frequent speaker at autism conferences. He writes often on autism science and public health policies for Age of Autism and has published numerous articles and commentaries on autism in journals such as Public Health Reports, the International Journal of Toxicology, the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, and Neurotoxicology and Medical Hypothesis. He has also been invited to peer review articles in journals such as the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Journal of Epidemiology and Pediatrics, and the International Journal of Toxicology. We will also be joined by Dan Olmsted. He is an investigative reporter and former senior editor of United Press International and the assistant national editor of USA Today. He publishes columns on health and medicine regularly in the Washington Times and is the editor of the Age of Autism website, providing daily updates on the autism epidemic. The Columbia Journalism Review called his site's columns, quote, some of the most enterprising contributions to the autism debate, and have led to the introduction of a 2006 House bill by Representative Carolyn Maloney calling for scientific studies into the thimerosal-autism relationship. Nice to have you with us today, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Gary.
Mark, we're going to begin with you, and then after you've given your thoughts, Dan, you can add your own if you believe that he's missed anything you wish to contribute to it. First, we look at the larger issue. The larger issue is that we have been led to believe that autism is genetic, that autism is not due, and environmental, it is not due to vaccines. In fact, there has been multiple efforts within this court system, within the legislature, within the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease, and a myriad of medical organizations to state that anyone even challenging this notion is irresponsible. I would like for you now to take your time, without interruption, and present your arguments and your evidence as if you were in a court of law. We have a large audience listening. We have professionals, doctors, lawyers, engineers, judges, school teachers. We have parents of people, children with autism and other injuries. So you have a chance to lay your case out point for point. So please do so. Mark, we will start with you.
Sure. Well, I think, Gary, the thing that we've done in our book is to make the case that autism is a man-made disorder. And we do that, and we come up to the current controversies, but that's not where we want to start. We want to start at the beginning of autism, which we argue we can trace pretty precisely to a group of children born in the 1930s. One of the things that we've been able to do in our investigation is take the 11 original families and the 11 original cases described by Leo Kanner, who was the man who, quote-unquote, discovered autism in a 1943 paper. We've taken the descriptions that he provided in his paper and uncovered the real identities of seven of those original 11 cases and then been able to reconstruct the backgrounds of the families, the occupational activities of the parents in particular, and the kinds of chemicals that we think that those mothers and those families may have been exposed to. So that's where we started. We started with these original cases. And we argue that before these children were born in the 1930s, the rate of autism was effectively zero. Now, there are scattered cases that you can look to before that, you know, people that might have presented with symptoms that were similar to autism in some way. But by and large, those were scattered and never the kind of critical mass that we started to see more recently. So the rate of autism went from effectively zero, was discovered in very rapid fashion in clusters of children born in the 1930s, and then since then, for many years was sort of relatively rare but more frequent, and then in the last 10, 15, 20 years, we've had an explosion in autism cases to close to 1% of children born in the United States today. So we traced that trajectory. And then we asked the question, for those children born in the 1930s, those original people, we've traced the human histories, the occupational histories, what happened? What do we think happened to those individuals? And in every case, and almost, and with varying degrees of convincing evidence, we've been able to trace mercury exposure in general, in those families, and in particular, to a new form of a mercury compound that was first invented and commercialized in the late 1920s, a commercial compound called ethyl mercury, which was used both in fungicides in agriculture, used to treat seeds, to prevent fungal infections and sap stain in lumber, and also used as a preservative in biological products, including the first diphtheria toxoid vaccines. All of the products that were involved in these exposures were introduced for the first time in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and these families and these children, the mothers and the infant children, were exposed to these new applications of this new ethyl mercury compound. And in addition, they often had background exposures to mercury due to their occupations that may have raised the risk as well. So we trace that history. We make the case that these original cases were tied to exposure to mercury. And then as we move forward, that the expansion of autism around the world and in the United States was also closely tied in time and place to mercury exposure. talk for a bit. Dan, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
No, just make your entire... Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say, just to personalize it a bit, having identified seven of these cases, case number two is especially interesting. That is a child named Frederick Wellman, and his father was a plant pathologist at the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center outside Baltimore. And he was working with this very compound we're describing at the time his son was born. So that was quite something to see. And then we also found case one down in Forest. His name is Donald Triplett. I first found him about 5 years ago and wrote about him. Mark and I went down to see him last summer and videotaped him at home, and he has done remarkably well. The reason he's done remarkably well, according to his family, is that when he was going on 14, he was treated with Bolt salts. And because he had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, and at the same time that his arthritis cleared up, the autism symptoms also immensely improved, to the point that he really was able to function very well, go to college, be president of the Kiwanis Club, work at the bank, travel the world. So we think we see in those early cases not just evidence of cause, but evidence of recovery that's been overlooked since the 1940s, and this is pretty appalling. And also, hopefully, helpful to realize this is a treatable man-made disorder.
All right, let's go back to my original question. And, Mark, let's go through this again. What is the hard evidence you have to challenge the major agencies of government and the major pro-vaccine advocates that their statements that there is no connection between vaccine and thimerosal or ethylmercury or methylmercury and autism? Tell us what your arguments are to refute them.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Gary, whenever we get into the controversial part of this discussion is a lot of us who are concerned about questions of safety in these products get accused of being anti-vaccine. And the one thing that Dan and I both want to say is that we are not anti-vaccine. We, in fact, support safe vaccination practices. We support a conscientious and responsible public health policy that promotes positive total health outcomes in children, including, you know, the prevention of infectious disease, but also the prevention of chronic and neurological developmental disorders. So, you know, there's a lot of name calling that goes on in these controversies, and I think it's really important to stay focused on children and their health, which is what our arguments are all about. There are two bits of evidence, Gary, and there's a lot of science on these questions that is very supportive of a link between mercury and autism. But the two things I would point to that are probably simplest to get across is there was a recent review paper that was written in a scientific journal, and one of the interesting techniques that this author did was to do a search of all the literature that connected autism and mercury or autism and heavy metals, and it got past the propaganda and the political pronouncements that you often hear from government agencies that are trying to promote programs. And they asked the simple question, if we look at the evidence that connects mercury and autism, what does the evidence say? What do the studies say? And in their review, they found that there were something like 60 or so studies that fully 75% of those studies supported a connection between mercury and autism. And it supports it in a variety of ways, whether it's difficulties that autistic children have in excreting mercury or increased exposures to mercury provoking high autism risk, meaning environmental mercury, or in the case of vaccine exposures to mercury as well. So there is a broad-based scientific foundation for the connection between mercury and autism. And so that's something that I think people lose sight of, because if you were to listen to all the press releases in the media, you'd think that the overwhelming evidence goes in the other direction. In fact, no, the evidence supports the connection between mercury and autism. The other thing that I would point to is there has been, you know, an increasing body of work done in animal models. And animal models are very important because you can actually control, you know, the exposure level, and you can look in very detailed way at infants, and you can then, once you've exposed infants to these ethyl mercury exposures, you can then sacrifice them and do detailed investigations of the internal biology, the brains, the mercury levels in the body, you know, and how these infants turn out. And almost universally, when these studies have been done in infants, when you take ethyl mercury compounds, commonly called thimerosal, you inject them into infant animals at the clinically relevant amounts, the amounts that human infants have been exposed to in vaccine programs in the U.S. and all over the world. When you do that experimental work in animals, the results are absolutely unambiguous, conclusive, and convincing that these exposures cause harm. And the animals react in all sorts of ways, and you can, and different experiments have done different bits of work. They've observed slower developmental responses, slower feeding, impaired feeding in infancy, different responses to heat sensitivity, different patterns of growth. There's a whole range of things that these studies do. But in rats, in mice, in hamsters, and in monkeys, a bunch of groups all over the world doing it in different, you know, in largely similar ways, but with different models and different experiments, have produced the same outcome, which is, you know, the thimerosal exposures that we have seen in the past in childhood immunization programs that we're seeing today in flu, thimerosal preserved flu shots that are being administered to pregnant women and young infants. When we expose infant animals to those same concentrations, the outcomes are bad, and the injuries are clear. And when you put those two together, that you have, you know, in human populations, we see connections between mercury exposure and mercury risk in autism. And when we do detailed animal investigations, the biology is clear and compelling. You know, as a parent, as an advocate, you know, as a citizen, I find those, you know, those two strands of evidence to be pretty convincing. The other thing that we'd say is we're not arguing, you know, an extreme position here. We think that mercury is probably very, very good. It certainly was there at the beginning, is present at the scene of the crime, is very good at causing autism. But there may well be other toxins involved that are rising in our environment and that can do similar work in terms of provoking autism in children. It's not, as the overall childhood immunization program has expanded in its size and scope over the last 10 or 20 years, it's not clear how mercury exposure in some of these vaccines and the vaccines themselves, independent of mercury, might interact or contribute or combine to cause injury in infants. And so separating out those effects are pretty important. We're pretty convinced that mercury is bad for you, that it's pretty crazy to expose infants on purpose to ethyl mercury compounds or pregnant women on purpose. But it's not at all clear that mercury is the only thing that can be causing some of these adverse developmental outcomes.
Dan, please give us your insights on this.
Well, I certainly agree with that. Just in terms of the issue of broader toxic evidence, there was a study done in the 1970s by a very well-respected researcher named Mary Coleman at Georgetown University, and she found 25% parents of children with autism had exposure to toxic chemicals in their background, and only 1% of the other kids who were not afflicted with autism. And so you're seeing right away very clear evidence that toxic injury, perhaps involved with the genetic susceptibility, is the real nature of this. And the tragedy is they've gone so far wrong. First they were blaming parent behavior, and then they blamed their biology in terms of genes. And here we are, you know, several decades later, really barreling down the wrong track and having thousands and hundreds of thousands and maybe soon to be millions of afflicted children. Really a tragedy.
All right. This question is for whichever one of you want to answer it. We have had, and I've spent a lot of time investigating this, we have had a scoreboard that on one side gives the people who are pro-vaccines almost universally a vested interest financially, research grants, patent sharing, and then putting them on some advisory committee on the scheduling of vaccines at the CDC and the FDA, frequently more than 50%. And therefore, once the majority of the scientists who are giving a recommendation for a particular vaccine say yes, it goes forward. The public is given the assurance that these are the best experts in the United States or the world, and that the science is there to show that this particular vaccine is both safe and effective. These same individuals repeatedly said that mercury was not a factor that would cause any injury to the child when we had multitudes of studies showing that mercury at any dose is a neurotoxin, including one part per billion. We then had a very revealing tape, the type of tape that almost never happens, where Dr. Hilleman, the father of American vaccination, stated just before his death, in an interview that he asked for, he stated that virtually all the vaccines that he created, and he created the influenza vaccine and helped do the development of the polio vaccine with Sabin, etc., that they had contamination and that these could lead to cancer. He was very specific, saying that the hamsters that he had inoculated with the Sabin vaccine caused cancer, and Sabin was angry about it, but then when asked what are we going to do about it, they just decided to do nothing about it. They just covered it up. So that received virtually no publicity worldwide, and almost none in the scientific community, which would have repudiated much of the so-called safety aspects. I'm not talking about efficacy now, just purely safety.
Right.
Now what you have is we have been told there's no connection, and yet you go back and look at all the different scheduling, when it was one vaccine, then two, then 10, now 60. So they just keep adding in more vaccines, and the new research coming out today says obesity can be cured with a vaccine, AIDS with a vaccine, heart disease, cancer with vaccines. Everything is taking us towards vaccines, and so we're being told there's no number of vaccines that are too many for the human body to benefit from. And the ingredients in them, whether it's formaldehyde or aluminum, sulfate or mercury, are not harmful. If they were, we wouldn't put them in there because, after all, we're the best and the brightest. We're the ones who know best. And therefore, don't be concerned. How do you respond to this, since they're the ones who then control the media, and the media has been consistently siding with the idea that they wouldn't put anything into a vaccine that was harmful, irrespective of how many lawsuits and how much damage and awards has been from those parents who even were able to qualify, even after they discovered that their child had been injured by some of these vaccines, and especially those with autism, since that autism is going to be there the rest of their life unless they get some kind of unique help, which is available but not being discussed. Give us your insights, please.
Well, Gary, I think the problem, we've developed a very severe institutional problem in the governance of these products. And I think what we're missing here is the kind of consumer safety movement that we had in the automotive business where, you know, if you remember Ralph Nader talking about cars being unsafe at any speed, and, you know, there was substantial reform in the practice or the regulation of automotive vehicle safety. I think in the vaccine business, what we've seen is that vaccines have become a big industry. They've grown from something like $8 billion in total revenue 10 or 15 years ago to $28 billion. The flu vaccine in particular has grown from a $200 million industry to over a $5 billion industry, particularly with the swine flu windfall to the manufacturers last year. So we're talking about, and not only has the industry grown, it's become more profitable. The vaccines are higher priced. They're patent protected. They come with monopoly or near monopoly positions for the producers. So it is, in an otherwise bleak picture for the pharmaceutical industry, a very high growth, very profitable new segment for them to invest in. And so the companies like it, and the government regulators are too closely tied to the manufacturers, and what you have is something that you've seen in the military-industrial complex. You have this revolving door between the public health regulators and the companies that are making these new products, and they are all sort of in it together, and it's in their interest to take on new disease problems, to develop new products, to have exciting new programs exciting to them, and then to roll out the products and make them profitable and everybody does better. Except, when it comes to the question of safety, they don't ask the tough questions. They don't do the hard work, and in fact, they increasingly lower the bar for the kinds of safety studies that need to be done. So when they do clinical trials, they don't compare a vaccine to a placebo. They compare a vaccine to another vaccine, or they compare a new vaccine to the vaccine with active ingredients in it as opposed to an inert placebo. They cut corners, and they get the results they want, and they get the products into the marketplace. One of the most obvious examples of this was the woman who used to run the CDC, is a woman named Julie Gerberding. She had been in charge of the autism policies and all of these controversies around autism, mercury, the environment, whether or not autism was increasing, was on her watch. And when she left the CDC a year after she left, which was absolutely the minimum time to avoid federal conflict of interest issues, she joined Merck and is now the president of the Merck Vaccine Division. So if you have anything that tells you that the system is broken, that there are conflicts, and that the people running public health policy have a commercial incentive or a commercial orientation, the fact that Julie Gerberding left the CDC and is now running Merck's vaccine business, I mean, that's the most obvious example that you can find. So what we need is medical scientists to take the management of this policy, these safety policies, back from the medical industry and put the interests of consumers and their absolute interest in safety back in the driver's seat. And unfortunately, we've had a system that is this expansionist and profit-oriented and growth-oriented, and the view that more vaccines are better, and if one vaccine is good, then 20 must be 20 times as good. We need to get past that and say, what are the real health problems in children, and how can we address those? And I don't think people, any parent who's out there listening would say, gosh, I'm scared to death of measles, or I'm scared to death of diphtheria, or I'm scared to death of, some exotic virus that I've never even heard of. Are you scared of infectious disease, or are you concerned about the fact that your child might develop autism, or that your child might develop diabetes, or that your child might have ADHD or other learning disorders, or that your child might have a food allergy? The largest concern of parents in the current generation are all these new and chronic conditions. And obviously those conditions have risen, they've exploded, they've risen alongside the expansion in these new immunological interventions, and most of them are a result of some kind of immunological dysfunction. So it's certainly a reasonable question to ask whether, we're giving children too many vaccines too quickly, and whether if we slowed these programs down, we might have better health outcomes overall. That's the kind of regulatory oversight that we need from our federal health regulators, but it's not the kind we're getting because in the revolving door of Washington, we're seeing too much financial interest in the outcomes and the policies.
My final question, Dan, anytime that that I have interviewed parents, and I've interviewed over 1,200 parents, I've asked a basic question. When did you begin to notice that your child was developing differently? And the vast majority, well over 90% of the people I've interviewed, have said that the child was developing normally until 1.5 to 2.5, until they got a particular group of vaccines. And then there was inconsolable crying, there was fevers, and then there was just this withdrawal. And they could notice it, especially if they'd had other children that had not had that experience. And they were frequently told by their pediatricians, well, we just have to wait and see, this may be just normal. And by the time the child was finally diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, somewhere on that curve, it could be months later, and in several cases, a year or two later. But it was always, they told me, after the vaccines. Now, if a few people had told me this, out of all that I've interviewed, and I interview them in depth, they're not superficial interviews, that's one thing. But when over 90% of the people tell me this, I have to take that as serious. And yet, the federal government and its various agencies of oversight will tell you that the parents' input on anything involving the child's diagnosis of autism is really anecdotal and of no scientific basis. And I'm thinking, that is wrong. You cannot dismiss as of no relevance what a parent observes with the child. So in effect, it's almost Orwellian. That's why I did a half-hour Orwellian commentary prior to our program of how we've gotten to the point where we won't even trust our intuition, we won't even trust natural maternal instincts, we won't trust cause and effect, we won't even trust our own eyes. But we will automatically trust a bureaucrat in Washington telling us there's no connection between autism and vaccines. If you notice something, you really didn't notice it, you're not an expert, and therefore your opinions are irrelevant. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, you stated that very well, and that's exactly the experience I've had as a journalist. I think the, you know, the percentages of cases in which that applies is not clear, but it's a significant percentage, and I'm disappointed in my fellow journalists not doing what I would consider basic reporting and talking to people whose stories they're telling. It's worth noting that the federal government just a couple of weeks ago did, in fact, for the first time, clearly compensate a child, namely Hannah Poling, by conceding that vaccines in her particular case did result in autism. And they used a lot of, as you say, Orwellian language to try to dance around that, but people are realizing that is a breakthrough, and $20 million was the amount of money over her lifetime that she's going to get. If you multiply $20 million times the number of children with severe autism in this country, you're bankrupting not only the vaccine court, but you're looking into a figure that is trillion with a T. So there's a cynical attempt to suppress truth here, and I think ultimately it's going to fail, and it needs to fail as soon as possible so that we can prevent this and help sick kids.
I thank you very much, Dan Olmsted and Mark Blaxall, for your work and for this new work. Very important that people pay attention to it, and the website. I think that we need to read The Age of Autism, and we also have to pay attention to mercury, medicine, and the fact this is a man-made epidemic. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks for having us, Gary.
That is part one of our three-part investigative series today on autism and vaccines. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny will be our final speaker on the flu, politics, and vaccination, and ingredients now discovered in that should give everyone concern. My next panelist will be with us in just 60 seconds, Dr. Lawrence Plavinsky, and we're going to talk about the faulty science of vaccine research and safety. Please stay with us, back in a moment.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. Baby, my